We are coming to our third class together in the Hartman Foundations for a Thoughtful Judaism. We had a discussion in our first class about creation ethics. We had a discussion in our second class about covenant ethics. Can somebody give me bekitzur, like very, very short, because some people weren't at all of that. Bekitzur, what is creation ethics? What is covenant ethics? Bekitzur, short, very short.
Creation ethics is a more universal set of ethics, baseline foundation.
And what is the baseline?
That we are all created in image and likeness of God.
Beautiful.
And should treat each other accordingly.
Beautiful.
And the covenant ethics is more particular, more granular, maybe more, there are more specific rules or not rules, ethics around it, more particular.
So what is the particular? Beautiful, that creation, universal ethics are based in being created in the image of the divine. What is the covenant ethic based in? But yes, it's more particular. What's it based in?
Relationship.
Okay. So that's what we have as our two fundamental undergirding principles of how to decide things that are hard to decide. We would need ethics or morals or like a values conversation if it were easy. So these are always about things that are difficult decisions to make, whether it's resources to allocate, time and attention, whatever, care. I'm late getting here because my dog just did not want to get out of the house, and she's 16 years old, which is 107 or something in people years, and she's deaf and she's blind and she's confused. Like, so it's like, okay, I had a time frame, it was gonna work, I had a generosity of time to walk her and feed her and talk to my mentee on the phone because we missed a meeting yesterday, and so all of it was gonna be fine until it's not. So it's not for what it's all working fine. All of these conversations, all of the effort and effort of, in a good way, of thinking, of dreaming, of expanding, of contracting, of imagining, of budgeting, is about, we know things are limited. And there's an unlimited need. A rabbi, I worked with Rabbi Dale Friedman when I was doing work at the Philadelphia Geriatric Center all through my high school, Freudian slip, all through my college, rabbinic school career. I served every summer in the Philadelphia Geriatric Center for the whole entire summer, working with folks, one floor completely folks who had dementia and had no attachment to reality. The other, a floor of folks who were completely aware and alert and could not be mobile. So like the folks who had dementia were perfectly mobile, but they were locked in. The folks who couldn't move had their whole minds. And so watching all of that, where do we spend our time and effort and resources? And the rabbi said to me, because I came up there exhausted one time to her office and said, I don't know. There's two floors of needy people and I don't know. Should I spend more time in Florence's room or more time, you know, in Yaakov's room? Like I'm just, and I was sobbing. And she said, if you're going to last in this business, you're going to have to get it that there is unlimited need and you are a limited resource. And we all understand this in some way, whether it's parenting, you know, whether it's our monetary resources. And so I want to be very clear that this is what the rabbis are trying to address in all of the texts that we're going to look at. I don't think I've done a great job of setting that up and really communicating that, although that's what Hartman is trying to do, is they're not bringing these texts to say, this is halacha, this is Jewish law. These texts are being brought forward to say, this is how we as a people have dealt with the reality of having limited resources and unlimited need. And every human society has to deal with that because some people have more and some people have less. That's just always going to be the case. So all of this discussion about Jewish law and the Mishnah and the Talmud and whatever is not to look at Jewish law. It's to look at how did Jewish leading thinkers think about and put forward actual suggestions about how we should live given that we have limited resources and unlimited need. So I just want to articulate that very clearly. And if I stray too far from that, I want you all to bring me back. I've asked Stephen Lewis to keep me honest about really making sure we're at the values that we're talking about, not just case law. All right. So we're going to look at now, we've looked at creation ethics, we've looked at covenant ethics. We're now going to look at what happens when they clash. Because you can say, oh, well, this is my system. Or you can say, well, this is my system. This is how I rank everything. Okay, that's fine. But for all of us, there's actually gradations of both. We actually do feel a more urgent need to take care of our own folks in a certain way. And we also feel really committed to helping those who are most in need in the world community. So none of us are completely to one side or the other, creation or covenant ethics. All we're trying to do is suss out kind of two of the real pillars of our good, wonderful moral commitments and how we might fulfill those. And where now we're going to talk about where those clash. So we're going to begin looking at a source. And there's a lot of material in these sources. I'm not sure we're going to get through all this. I'm going to talk fast, so maybe we can. But if we don't, we don't. But I do want to get to at least the setting up of it, and then maybe the last text number 6 and 7. So what I want to do is look at source number 1, but there's a lot of text. So I don't want to be the only one talking. I'm talking already. I'm going to interject, obviously, and host the conversation. And there's a lot of material. So I'm going to suggest that I not read source number 1. I'm going to suggest that Bert Kleiman read source number 1. He's close to the microphone and his voice carries. We're going to look at Green responding to Singer. These are two philosophers, Green and Singer. They come each from the creation or the covenant side of this whole conversation.
Peter Singer has developed a powerful argument that apparently shows that most of us are far more immoral than we take ourselves to be. Many people follow a minimalist morality. They avoid killing, stealing, lying, and cruelty, but feel no obligation to devote themselves to the well-being of everybody else. We commend those who give generously to foreign aid, but we do not look on those who fail to give as unthinking criminals or moral reprobates. According to Singer, our standard moral judgments are seriously askew. Those who fail to do what they can to alleviate the absolute poverty of the worst off in the world are not quite as bad as murderers and thieves, for they do not intentionally act in such a way as to kill and deprive others. They are, however, as bad as reckless drivers who act in a way which will cause death and destruction without desiring these predictable consequences.
All right, so we get what just happened here? Okay, go ahead.
If such a theory has consequences which conflict with our intuitions, it is possible that we need to revise our intuitions and the behavior that follows. But it is also possible that our intuitions give us reason to revise our principles. Rather than being faced with one drowning child easily saved by individual action, our situation is comparable to that of the strong swimmers on the beach at Bondi after a freak wave has washed away the sandbank. Many people are drowning, and at least a goodly number have a prima facie obligation to help them. But which one is any particular strong swimmer to save? In a situation like this, a pragmatic principle solves the decision problem. Each drowning person has an equal right to be saved. Efficiency dictates that one saves the closest. If one person is equally close to two potential rescuers, they should coordinate their activities, one agreeing to save the closest, the other the next closest. Lifeguards divide their responsibility for saving people on the beach, thus turning a diffuse and unfulfillable duty into a particular and achievable one. Without a pragmatic tiebreaker, which divides their responsibility, the collective aim of saving as many of the drowning as possible would not be
achieved.
Would not be achieved. By analogy, we will not solve the problem of international poverty and starvation by putting individuals in a situation in which they feel guilty if they merely pay their taxes and care for their own families. We need rather to formulate principles of organization that will enable each country to fulfill its obligation towards its own people. A fair way of dividing the responsibility for children was to make parents responsible for their own children. In a similar fashion, an imperialist perspective could come up with no better scheme for dividing responsibility among nations than to make each nation responsible for the care of its own people. This has the same sort of advantages as dividing responsibility for children. Each nation has its own history, customs, and priorities. No matter how strange and ungrounded these may seem to outsiders, they will be the sorts of things nations will want to develop in their own way, just as a family that is sufficiently well-run offers, besides basic care, a history, a set of habits, and sense of one's place in the community. So a state that is sufficiently well-run offers a set of traditions, a history, and a sense of one's place in the international community. Each nation has a prima facie obligation to care for its own people, and in a well-ordered system of divided responsibility, it will then have no further obligations.
All right. So let's not go to, thank you, Bert. Let's not go to no further obligations. Let's chop that off for a second. Because what we're going to look at here, obviously, is a response by Karen Green to Peter Singer, right? And so just tell me your first perspectives on how this text lands. What are the things it achieves? What doesn't it achieve? Where are we doing well with this? Where are we not?
To me, it seems a touch dramatic and aspirational.
In terms of
the examples given, it just seems very, I don't know. For example, the whole lifeguard, if a wave came and crashed and everyone's freaking out and people are drowning, I just feel like it's very rare, or maybe it's not, I don't know, but in those types of circumstances to treat it like it's very simple what needs to be done here, and you choose your closest person and you take the time and we have this discussion, and then you go get someone a little farther away.
So if we take that as a metaphor, it's not dramatic. It's just, because it is dramatic what we see in the world.
Right.
People are starving and they're dying. Children are dying daily, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. So let's take, there is a drowning, a massive drowning happening. That's what's actually happening in the world. What do you think about this approach? I get it. It's dramatic. It's a dramatic example. And for the parents of those children, this is what's happening. And it's massive. So what Green is arguing is how you can't save everybody. You can't run in and save everybody. So there's a lot of people on the shore. There are a lot of people drowning. That's our world. How do you decide who you're going to save? Her argument is, if you push into the water, who are you going to save? How do you decide? That one has better hair. That one is a stronger swimmer. They're a stronger person. So we should save the stronger.
Younger.
She's saying you go to the closest to you because that's the best way. If everyone on shore runs to the closest person drowning and pulls them in, that's the most, and then the second wave goes to the closest. That's the most effective way to save the most amount of people. It's dramatic, yes. But if we go to life and death, that's what's happening all around this planet. So if we stay with that she's saying the only way to do it is triage by who's closest. And then if everyone did that over and over again,
in their own
pond where people are drowning, it would result in the saving of most people. Now, the metaphor, of course, is proximity means, in her mind, relationships, right? So that's what we talked about in terms of covenant ethics, right? So here's an argument for covenant ethics, right? Any reactions that we want to?
Well, I think if you're going with ethical triage, which is what this is.
Mm-hmm.
In triage, you don't treat the person that has the cut on their finger first. You treat the person who is, number one, not going to die for sure, but who is the most in need. And then you cut back that way and you get to the person with the cut finger at the end. So you go to the one with the most need that you can save for, rather than the one with the easiest proximity.
Dr. Harvey, thank you for teeing up. Mm-hmm. What's going to be? Creation, no, you teed it up beautifully. That's exactly the tension. Because if we're talking triage, we're talking assessing how bad is the wound. Is it fatal? Is it mid-level? Is it a flesh wound and you'll be fine, so I got to go to someone else? So where the metaphor breaks down is that you could go to everyone next and this person will survive. Like in her metaphor, everyone's drowning. Like, so everyone's dying. So you have to get to the one closest to you, but you're right to exactly hold that level of understanding of triage. Say it again.
Speaking of using the drowning metaphor, you're making a decision on the ground.
Using the drowning metaphor is saying people are dying everywhere. And who do we save? So it really isn't dealing with flesh wounds. It's really I use the word triage. She didn't. Because she's saying people are dying everywhere in this world. How do we decide who to save?
Wouldn't most of us naturally first try to save children? As maybe as an emotional connection, whether it's your own or another child, rather than the rational approach of picking the person that's closest to you?
So I don't think a lot of this is rational. I think this is based in who are we responsible for? And what I hear you saying is that wouldn't we feel most responsible as adults to someone who's not an adult? So, but then I'd ask you back, Terry, what about children who are dying here and children who are dying someplace else of whatever they're dying of? Yes, our instinct is to save children. Maybe first, even. We say, okay, we're going to save the animals and the children because they're completely dependent. Who do we save first? Who do we put most of our resources towards? Those children who are in our care or those children far away? And how do we split that difference? So it's not an either or. I'm not asking for an either or. We're going to look at texts. The rest of the shiur is to get into texts that talk about the nuance of that and the nuance of who we're responsible for on all kinds of levels. Yes.
I was not happy with this at all.
With which?
With a lot of it.
Okay.
I don't like the drowning metaphor because there is a difference between foreign aid and helping other countries, which is where she ends up, and someone who is drowning if I don't get them out of the water immediately.
To articulate the difference for me. What's the difference? Kids who need food right now, or they're going to die of famine, or they don't have a vaccine right now, they're going to die of cholera.
Her argument is about countries. Her argument is you other countries, you take care of your own. Don't ask us.
Wait. That's not what she's saying. She said, what if every country said, we're going to take care of our children. We are going to call them ours and we're going to take care of them. What if that were the universal system? She's not suggesting that's what's happening right now. This is what we should do right now. What if every country said, we are going to prioritize our vulnerable children? Then wouldn't the world be taking care of its children? That's the question.
That is absolutely true. And I think the Mashiach will come first before that happens.
Right.
Okay. So that's one piece. The tone, and maybe I was just reading it. The tone to me was a very uncompassionate tone. Mm-hmm. It really was not. The one thing that I did find interesting, and I do find interesting, and I'm not sure she brought it up here, is how sometimes people can get all this compassion for the starving children way over there, and yet just drive by the homeless on our current streets. And I'm not sure she really dealt with that issue.
So I think she's raising proximity as one level, like one level of concern. And then, like, we've said children. She didn't say children. Like, she might have said children and the homeless that you drive by deserve the same amount of, I said children. She's talking about people drowning. I said children somewhere, I guess. But to your point, like, I get it. Okay, tone. I accept that and get that. It's like, whatever. But if we get to the heart of the actual having to designate resources, mm-hmm. how do we make those decisions? And so this is a conversation about the homeless, the children, the whatever in our precinct is, according to mm-hmm. Green, if everyone did that, and we talked about that in covenant ethics, that, okay, then that would create a certain reality. Okay. And I get it that, like, there's other considerations, so until we're going to look at other texts that do that.
The fallacy's argument is that it says that each nation has a prima facie obligation to care for its own people, but the resources of each nation are dramatically different.
Yes.
The resources of the United States to take care of its people is very different than the resources of Sudan to take care of its people.
Yes. So if I say to you, in her perfect, and I'm not arguing for her, I'm just saying, if in a perfect world, each country gave what it had, given that they're vastly different, to taking care of their own, might that not create, rather than keeping it for themselves and building palaces, including here, might that not be an ethical, moral conversation we'd want to have? That every country, there should be a charter. If we had our ethical dream come true, we would say every country must minimally take care of its own to the extent that they can. Then we could have a conversation about global resources. Would you agree with that? That every country should at least agree we're going to take care of our own poor
first.
We're going to take care of our own who can't fall below a certain level that we've agreed as a society we're going to have a net below which no one falls. And that's where we're going to focus our priority. That's the posit. That's the question.
The problem with that argument is that there are a lot of legacies of colonialism mm-hmm. where countries have been deliberately been impoverished and their resources taken away by richer companies, by richer companies.
And still today.
And that's still there, yeah.
Of course.
And, you know, to say that people people anywhere that once that had their resources robbed by a more powerful country, it's not sufficient to say that that poor country today has resources robbed is still responsible to the extent it can for taking care of its people, because it can't take care of its people because the bigger, more powerful countries.
Okay. Can we ask the question right now? They've been robbed. They've been stolen from. They've been colonized. Great. Understood. Should their priority be using their resources to care for their own poor and vulnerable to the extent that they can? Should that be? Okay. So then if we say, of course, then what? Like, but it's interesting that we like say, oh, wait, but they've been this, they've been that. But should the ethical priority be for that government now? It's not controlled by the United States. It's not controlled by Britain. Should they ethically commit their resources to taking care of their poor? Forget the world conversation. We're going to have that conversation in a minute. Like that's what she's suggesting, that every country has to assume responsibility at least. Maybe it means going and brokering a deal with another country, right? For whatever, for reparations, for whatever, but their responsibility is to their poor.
Necessary, but not sufficient.
And maybe not sufficient. All right. So, Faye?
Oh, I was just going to say, we all live like that.
Yes. So that's where we're going to get to, is that we all are making these decisions all the time, right? We are all trying to figure out all the time, like how to spend our resources, where we allocate them, how we allocate them as a community, as a synagogue, as a family run, you know, foundation, right? We're always trying to figure out where are we obligated. And that's what we're going to look at in these texts.
To be a fair person, that it's more than a very rare. Right.
And so it's not even frowned upon so much in the literature that you keep more than you give. It's more about how do we decide where and how much to give? Because this is where we all live. We're going to give some. Those of us who are comfortable in this room, I think we could all agree we're comfortable enough to give something to somewhere. There's some surplus for each of us in this room. So the question is about the ethics about and the ethical system and the thinking and the philosophy behind how do we decide where to give and how much to give, not just of money, but a surplus of time, of energy, of focus, of talent, of potentially earnings that we're going to turn down because we're volunteering, like, and then real resources, real money.
I don't know if she's intending readers to take this literally. This is a proposal for World Foreign Aid. I think it's really just the whole thing is a metaphor, and it's basically
yes.
If we have to, like, you can't just say you are an immoral person if you don't give every dollar you have to charity, leaving yourself with just barely enough to live, which is what the starting guy essentially is saying.
And that is not any of the conversation. Because we are not absolutists. So there's no fundamentalism here. It is all a conversation because the whole point of this is to speak to us in our own lives about how do we make complicated decisions, which we do all the time about the allocation of our surplus. Like I said, not just money, but time, intention, attention. Like,
so she's just saying what we read during Covenant Ethics is you take care of your circle. And then you take care of the next bigger circle, and you take care of the next bigger circle. And that's basically, that was in whatever it was, the Talmud. And someone here was saying that if everybody did that, at some point, if you had a lot, your circle would start overlapping with someone else's circle who doesn't have so much. So I think that's really all she's saying. She's not saying, you know, there's no expectation that governments are going to take care of their poor. But the idea is at least you can say, it's not on me to do for you what you're not doing for yourself.
So it's interesting you say that because I actually think some of us have a philosophy that the reason we pay taxes is so that our institutions will take care of the poor. So I don't have to make that decision, right? I vote for a candidate and a legislature that will allocate my taxes to taking care of the poor and alleviating their suffering.
But if they're spending money on this and they're not taking care of the poor,
then so that's where So we have it both at the big level of who we vote for, as well as in our own lives and our own sense of surplus. So if we look at the, let's look at the second text, the Tosefta from Bava Metzia. So here's a practical example of the rabbis who are dealing with Jewish ethics and Jewish law and Jewish values. Like, you have a case of a cistern, which belongs to the people of a town. If there's enough water only for the townspeople or others, right, then the Tosefta comes to say the townspeople have precedence over the others. Think about COVID, right? This is where I go when I'm like, wait, does it have to be one or the other? Okay, well, because sometimes it is. Others or the townspeople, animals, the lives of others have precedence over the animals. Rabbi Yossi says that the townspeople's animals have preference before the lives of the others. The animals of the townspeople or the animals of others, the animals of the townspeople have precedence over the animals of others. Drinking water for the others or the laundry of the townspeople, the lives of others have precedence over their laundry. Rabbi Yossi says that the laundry of the townspeople comes before the lives of the others. The laundry of the townspeople or the laundry of others, the laundry of the townspeople comes. So, when we read this, we tend to get very outraged. How can you be talking about my laundry in my town for my people is more important than the livestock that are going to feed another town? And so at first I had the same reaction. I'm like, what is Rabbi Yossi actually addressing? Like, and like, first of all, like our reaction is interesting. Like everyone around the room reacted the same way I reacted when I read it. And yet when I thought about it and like looked at it deeper and looked at the commentary on it, actually we do this all the time. We do this all the time. My daughter says to me, I need a new computer. Why do you need a new computer? And first of all, she's been taught since this high, the poor thing, I need, mommy. So what you need is my love, attention, affection, a roof over your head, food in your mouth, education. Like, that's what you need. Everything else is want. So learn to say, I want, mommy, not I need. Just me, I need a new computer. So that is what we talk about when we talk about water in a town. Is the basic stuff that I said you need, then you want a new computer. But in her experience, and then I respond to it, by the way, she does need a new computer because this has happened and the port's broken on the outside and blah, 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 blah. And so that's laundry to other people. So we laugh and we kind of go, oh my God, right? But really, we often spend on the laundry of our family before we address the absolute dire need for food and medication and education and protection of other people in this world.
I talk about the environment. You know that creating stability in our group or our community is environmental health.
So say more what that means. Because environmental health, a lot of us think a lot of things.
Is it that laundry is hygiene?
Yeah, so I've been thinking that too as we're reading. Like if we're not washing our clothes and then mold is growing and people are having sicknesses and illnesses, like that would be a very literal unpacking of that. So when I said environment, that meant a catch-all for conditions, you know, like living conditions.
Right.
So, right, to me, buying a new computer or a device or something might be like, well, why don't you just spend that money on whatever other wonderful giving that I can do, but it's like these are tools, you know, that I use to sow my seeds and, you know, create other resources because I have stability in order to generate that. So I take it as you're not experiencing chaos. You can, in your own world, you can have a clean environment to help other people and continue to generate energy out of that.
So what else could laundry stand for? Because I hear you saying it's preventing disease. I get it. But like, so it's encouraging our survival. What else does laundry stand for? In Rabbi Yossi's argument that laundry takes precedence over their need for basic sustenance. What is he saying? These are not idiots. These are the greatest thinkers of our tradition. So they're not going to unpack it for us, but they're not stupid. They're thoughtful people. He is a leader arguing for in saying laundry takes precedence.
Purity?
What did you say, Terry?
Purity?
Purity? No.
Purity. Good. I was afraid of that.
I know. Yeah, good. I'm glad you checked it out.
The cleansing.
No.
Okay.
What?
Take laundry literally to mean clothing, and you identify the people in your tribe by what they wear. The laundry might be a way of identifying your people.
So then it's still like us and them and identification. What is laundry and clean clothes? Think bigger. Think really big.
Is it a nice to have?
Like universal maintenance.
Pleasant.
Huh?
Things that make our lives pleasant.
And therefore, what happens? If your life is pleasant, what happens?
Prosperity. Abundance.
Prosperity, abundance. What else?
You're more likely to be generous.
You're more likely to be generous. You are more likely to develop thoughtfulness, thoughtful people. people who are educated, because you're going beyond the sustenance level. If your society has clean clothes and dignity and some other things, then what Rabbi Yossi is arguing is you then become a society that will be one that encourages others, like to, you'll be encouraged to give. You'll be encouraged to help others who are not there yet. You'll be encouraged to have music and art and literature and all the things that actually help a society grow to one that will be one beyond just sustenance level and have the ability to think about all this.
So Ellie, I'm raising her hand. I mean, she needs a new computer because that's going to raise her knowledge and the if water is raising all the time, then that's
So I bought her the new computer because I believe in Rabbi Yossi's argument that I could have used that money to give to people who are starving somewhere else. I didn't, because A, covenant ethics tells me my daughter's success in this world is my job. That's my first responsibility. Second, if I can raise a thoughtful young woman who's also, let's all agree, powerful, stubborn, opinionated, cheeky, there's like all that, that donor, she got that all from the donor. Then like, if I can raise another young woman who is out in the world doing that, then I raise a young woman who's going to influence other people to do the right thing and give more of their money to more just causes. So this is Rabbi Yossi, who at the face of it looks like he's crazy, but that's his argument, that if you take some of your resources and channel them to your community becoming one that can then be ultimately one that helps more people and cultivates an awareness in more of the population of needing to help more people, like then it just expands the good in a way that helping a few have lunch tomorrow doesn't. And I clearly made that decision.
I really appreciate what you said there, because I'm a little confused by some of these, but what I meant by cleansing is if we raise the level of certain people who are moral, If we concentrate on bringing moral people as high as we can, then those people who get the stuff, the money, whatever it is, will spread that stuff out in an intelligent way. You understand what I'm saying?
The standard of
I do, but the distribution of resources is not based on who's moral. You don't just raise who's moral.
Well, no, I'm not saying it's based on who's moral. I'm saying it's based on intelligence and all sorts of things. But if the higher level people, let me just say one sentence. If the higher level people that have all the resources and power are moral, then they'll be
but
doing that.
Morality is supposed to be the result of a society. It's not that you raise the level of the intellectuals and the most moral. It's not a choice. It's who's closest to you. That is what makes it moral. Okay. Not that the kid you're giving to is bright. Not that the kid you're giving to is moral. It's that if we take responsibility for all of the boats around us and raise the water level of more boats, then more boats have the opportunity to go out to sea and take their message, right? It's not about which boat is more worthy. Like, that will figure itself out and sort itself out. Our job, says Rabbi Yossi, is to lift the level of the water, right? So that
rising
all boats are lifted, and therefore you're more talented, you're more intellectual, you're more moral. They can go out there a little more quickly and find the opening to the bay.
My only argument, just very quick, but out of respect, is that, as it says here, an unfulfillable duty. Not all boats are the same. Some are going to work and some are not.
That's right. So our job is to lift the water level, right?
I just have a question. Rabbi Yossi said that if townspeople's animals have precedence over the lives of others, does not Judaism hold human life sacred above
them? Yes. So he's not saying, So this is, this is like one of those in your faces kind of midrashim where it's like really where the rubber meets the road. Theoretically, yes, Human life, of course, takes precedence over animal life. Animal life is what sustains human life in these systems. So, yes. So it's like, so if our people are going to die because we don't have the animals that we depend on, then we die. Like, so yes, you're 100% right.
The animals
and
the towns.
Yes.
Yep.
But if you follow this argument out, it turns into trickle-down economics. Because laundry, a laundry, fur coat, a better car, at what point do you stop and say, it's enough, we need to go the other way?
A very good intro to our next text. Thank you for the tea up party. Right, exactly. And trickle-down economics, I believe, where it failed on so many levels, but where it ultimately really broke down is that the assumption was you're dealing with an ethical code for those people.
Yeah.
That's what was wrong. The theory is not wrong. This is a trickle-down theory. It's not wrong theory. It's what is your underlying decision-making apparatus for I need a fur coat, like I deserve a fur coat over someone else having, and like we do it all the time, including my daughter's laptop, over someone else having a meal for their family for a week. So we do it all the time. The difference is Judaism assumes you're going to be arguing like this vociferously, constantly, all the time about where that should be and how that should be and blah, blah, blah. How high do we rise the water versus when do we repair some boats that are not doing so great? Maybe an inch less of water and maybe more into that boat that's not going to launch when we raise the water. So, but that's going to be a constant argument and conversation. Yep. Trickle down economics assume people were having that. And guess what?
Amen.
The people they were addressing were not. All right. So let's go to source number three. So, the Tanai de Rabbi Eliyahu. Someone want to read this text? I have to do it loudly and into this thing over here, this apparatus.
You volunteering. Thank you. Okay.
10th century Tanai.
If someone has food in their home and wishes also to give charity and support others from his resources, then how should they do so? First, one supports one's parents. If there is surplus, then support your siblings. If there is a surplus, then support your extended family. If there's a surplus, then support those in your neighborhood. If there's a surplus, then support those in your city. If there's a surplus, then support the rest of the Jewish people.
Remember, this is being written by Jews for Jews who had no ability to help non-Jews. So let's just be clear about that before everybody freaks out. Like, this is written for Jews, by Jews, for people who are living in exclusively Jewish communities. They can't give. Yeah, okay. So, so here we have, you give immediately to your, that. I want to just keep it. This generation of folks in the room and say, parents and children, even going with covenant ethics, right? Even to say we're going to go completely green, we're going to go completely with the covenant ethics. Your circle first. Already isn't there tension between what we give to our parents and what we give to our children or our grandchildren? If you're blessed to have all of those generations and our siblings, like there's already within that some tension about
what is surplus. And surplus is like, how she defines surplus.
What is surplus?
Like, at what point do you say I have enough?
Right. I'm going to buy a new car because I need one, and or I'm going to help my fill in the blank grandchild go to college. Like it, this is this, even if we go with just covenant ethics, there are real tensions. And I've seen in my study over 26 years of being a rabbi, more pain over family distribution of resources than I have over anything else. Mm-hmm. And you could say, yeah, but Rabbi, what about betrayal? Betrayal is a big part of that, right? People feel betrayed by the way things play out in the distribution of whether it's an estate, whether it's time and attention, whether it's giving resources of access You know, like there are all kinds of ways that people, in my experience, feel more intensely around the the unequal allocation of resources within a family than anyone wants to talk about the difference between when they're surplus, do you give it to aid outside of America or inside LA or like, right? It is very difficult, even within covenant ethics, to say, okay, so we're going to take care of those close to us first. The gradations of that and the emotions and associations of allocations within even our smallest circle of care is huge. So when we say, oh, well, this is an easy conversation, of course you take care of yours first. Okay, you can't even say that. Like, who of yours do you take care of? To what extent? Well, this one has been more successful, so I'm not going to leave as much to that or help them as much. This one has been less successful. Yeah, but isn't that kind of their fault, says the other one? They've never done anything. So why are you helping? Everyone helps them more all the time. And here I've been working my butt off, my tushy off. I'm making more and I get less because I've been working harder. Like, why? How is that fair? Right? So like the whole, it just doesn't break down as easily as we think it does. That our closest circles of care, like, oh, well, that's obvious. Okay. Yeah, really? Well, even with it, if you say that's obvious, great, or not, whatever. But like, even that is fraught, right, with lots of levels of trying to discern what is moral, what are our own ethical, moral, true norths around that.
It is the question.
Around our closest circle of care, right?
But isn't this text is there to minimize that tension and to make those rules, or help us make those rules, or to make those rules for us?
What do you mean?
I mean, you're saying you've seen, and we all have stories, you know, just related to resources and parents or whoever following these rules, giving their resources to their children, to their grandchildren, to their parents, whatever the case may be. This seems very straightforward, this text.
Right.
So in following this, maybe there should be no tension.
Right.
But I guess my point is this, it feels like this text is trying to put rules, objective rules, around something that is so fraught with subjectivity.
Because it's torturous.
Right.
It's torturous. So the Tana de Eliyahu says, it's torturous. So here's what we're going to advise.
Right.
Right. Because they know that this school of thought knows it's torture for every family. Right. And in their reality, that might have been maybe even a majority of the times the case. The elders are the ones who needed the care. We live in a very complicated social system where I think we long for what you're saying, that here's the clear outline of how it should be, because then we can kind of go, okay, like, right. But they are answering for their time. And we understand that it's our time in 2020, whatever it is, America, to figure out, and in our non-nuclear families, our blended families, our families of choice, because I don't have family of origin to worry about anymore. I have a very concentrated family of choice. So how to make decisions of allocations of, forget even money, but time and attention and where you lean in, and this one needs more. What it's inviting us into, this is why Hartman brings it forward, is what would our hierarchy be? Like, I would love each of you, if we had the time right now, to sit with this text and say, for you right now, in your circle of care, who would be primary? Who secondary? Who tertiary? Like, what? How would you make those decisions? Like, blah, 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 blah. What's happening for them right now? Blah, blah, blah. Here's who I really think. Or can you not do blah, 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 blah? It changes every day based on who needs me more. And like, one of my favorite Jewish adages that I hear from elders is, I'm only as happy as my most miserable child. Right? So it doesn't matter if you have, if you have one, it's easier. Well, I don't know. But if you have like six, forget about it. Somebody's miserable all the time. So the parents are always kind of miserable. So it's like, how do you allocate your time and attention? right, to the folks in your care who you consider your closest circle of responsibility.
I think there's another nuance to the giving, and we sort of touched on it a little bit in this class, and I would be interested to know what the rabbi said about it. You have limited resources. That's part of the issue. Do you give what it will do the most good, or do you give what will do the most need? So do you take $50,000 and pay for an unprivileged kid to go to college and change his or her life? Or do you feed 1,000 people in sub-Saharan Africa? Do they have a comment on that?
There's the whole reason we have so many texts tonight is because it's about there's not a resolution. Because this is... But what we have is a context for the conversation. So if we were sitting together as a community saying, okay, we have X amount of dollars that we're ready to allocate, and we're going to try to figure out, do we buy a scholarship for one kid, and then we take a bunch of applications and pick the kid we feel has the best chance or whatever we want, because this boat, her boat, is the most sound and ready to go? Do we do that? Or do we say we're going to scatter this much money over this much population that gets this much of aid, each of them, because it will just help for today and get them through another day. So there is no absolute, but what we're studying are some approaches to understanding how do we begin to prioritize that, right? And so we're going to get to one that actually talks about splitting some of it out, which is text number 6. So, but we're not even close to that. All right. So, text number 4, to answer y'all who have already been saying it, Bert, please.
Now there is something fundamental about the details of the laws above that troubles me deeply. For if we explain the texts that I have cited according to their simple meaning, that certain groups are prior to others, they imply that one may distribute the entirety of one's tzedakah money to one group within the established hierarchy and need not give it all to those who fall outside of that specific group. But it is well known that every wealthy person has many more relatives who are poor, and how much more is that true for people whose charity funds are scant? And if this is the case, poor people without wealthy relatives will die of starvation. Now, how is it possible to say this? Therefore, in my humble opinion, the explanation of charity priorities is as follows. Certainly, every person, whether of modest or significant means, is obligated to give a portion of their charity money to needy people who are not relatives. But to their poor relatives, they should give a greater amount than is given to those who are not related, and so on among the ladder of priority.
So this is to exactly your point, that there are going to be people who, if we say the problem with divided responsibility, like, you know, we divvy up responsibility according to who's in closest proximity. The problem with that is if you already take to Phil, your point that, there are countries who are so impoverished that they can't take care of their own. So if you assume there are both families and countries who they're so poor that they can't possibly support their own, then don't we have an obligation to both support our own and make a portion of our contribution be to those who don't have somebody as their family who can take care of them?
One thing that's interesting here is that it's about obligation and not deservingness. I mean, there's nothing in there about who you have to give to is worthy. So you can have a parent who was horrible to you. It doesn't say give to your parent if that parent was a great parent. It's like you take care of that parent regardless. So none of this is based on your subjective assessment of their work.
Correct. Correct.
It's all obligation.
Correct. That is the traditional. And we can have a discussion about that and talk about that. Like, it is the traditional understanding in that kind of ethical system that the people closest to you are deserving of your assistance as they need it, regardless of their worthiness. Now, I would argue from my position as a contemporary thinker, reflecting on these texts and all the values that we want to bring forward from it, if someone has been in an abusive relationship, And it's a continued abuse of the person to support someone who's been abusive, then I, of course, would argue that is not an obligation that we have. I don't care how close they are to you. If it's been abusive and you have to now come into the position of supporting someone who's been abusive, that's its own kind of abuse. And that comes first. That protection of who we are and our nefesh and our neshama comes first in terms of if it's a threat to us. And I believe that is one of the threats we could imagine. And all of you know, it's not a surprise to you that I was estranged from my mother for the last 7 years of her life. I was not supportive in all of the, and forget, you know, financial, whatever. When we talk about support, like I was not supportive because it was an abusive relationship that I was not going to participate in and that would have furthered my suffering and whatever. So like, the purpose of bringing these forward is to bring us into conversation. And then that's a very important point of conversation is how does worthiness enter the conversation?
I think that's a really important point, and I appreciate what you said with your situation. I was in an extremely father details, but do I hate him for the rest of my life? What happened was he spent the rest of his life, and this is a sort of a 12-step thing, but my grandfather, my mother's father, got him into AA, and he spent the rest of his life making amends for what he did, violence with my mother and myself. So because of all the details in this thing, isn't part of this, if he's talking about morality, I'm not challenging you. I'm saying, is it part of all of also us for to give the people who want to change the chance to make amends to us?
This is talking about substance.
Well,
right.
So well, yeah, right. Yeah, no.
We're talking about supporting folks. Like, if of course anyone who wants to change, we should have a society that helps them change.
Right. Well, can we forgive them? As I'm saying, if they're bad once, I'm interrupting you.
No. It's that we're not getting into forgiveness. That's a whole conversation we're not having.
Okay.
We're having a conversation about resources. So when we have resources, what are the underpinnings about how we make decisions about where we spend it? So if we look at the text we just came from, it said that we now can say, yes, we need to take care of those closest to us in terms of expending those resources. And we have to assume there are people who don't have that. So that's a new factor entering the conversation, right? The ethical conversation, the philosophical conversation. Assuming there are people who don't have anybody who can do that, then don't we have an obligation to at least apportion some portion of our support to people who don't have any of that? And like I said, I took it to the national level with you saying folks have been colonized and their countries have been raped for their resources. And now they don't necessarily have access to the resources to take care of their own folks. Don't we owe something to them? So that is an element being brought in text 4. Now we're going to look at text 5, looking at almost to the absurd of the idea of Green's philosophy. So this is an answer, a cheeky boom to the chin answer to Green from the Babylonian Talmud, Tanit.
Eliezer, the man of Birta, whenever the communal fundraisers would see him, they would run and hide. For whatever he had with him, he would give them. One day he went to the market to buy some items for his daughter's dowry. The charity collector saw him and hid from him. But he ran after them and said to them, I swear you must tell me, with what cause are you busy? They answered, with the marriage dowry of an orphan boy marrying an orphan girl. He said to them, I swear by the temple worship that those needy brides take precedence over my own daughter. He took everything he had with him and gave it to them. Only one coin remained in his possession, and with it he bought some grains of wheat. And when he came home, he climbed up and threw them into the storage room. His wife came home and asked her daughter, what did your father bring you? The daughter replied, whatever he brought, he threw in the storage room. She went to open the door of the storeroom and found that it was so full of wheat that the wheat was pouring out of the door hinges and that the volume of the wheat made it impossible to open the door. She, the daughter, went to the study hall and said, come and see what your beloved, your friend, did for you. He replied to her, as far as you are concerned, I swear by the temple worship that it is all dedicated to sacred use, and you have no more priority claim on it than any of the poor of Israel.
So sorry, I misspoke when I said this is a cheeky response to Green. It's a response to Singer, right? That need should determine, need should be the sole determinant of where we give, right? This is the most absurd example of that, right? So that none of it belongs to you, daughter, because this is a miracle made from heaven. And so obviously it's meant to go to everybody else. And so these are the kinds of circumstances where if we're going to extend past just monetary resources, then the resources of time, attention, care, all of that, that says, I give it to everybody else, and then I come home, and there's nothing left for y'all, right? So folks who go, if you take Singer, so we've seen Green to the extreme means you don't take care of anybody else. Like, that's a problem. Singer to the extreme is you give to everybody else first. That becomes your priority, and then the folks you come home to have nothing from you, right? Because you're busy giving it away. And I see this all the time.
Is there a notion, though, where they don't have anything left for themselves either and then get resentful? Because I don't like how the whole obligation piece from the previous statement, and it feels like, I mean, and I know, like, you know, it's just so not like not ideal state. That
right. So in place of obligation, what if we just use the word should? You should take care of. That's the language we would use. The rabbi's language is obligated. Mm-hmm. We don't like that because we're Americans and we free choice and we're free and independent and blah, blah, blah. So I get it. Like, we're raised to hate that language, which mm-hmm. I totally understand. I've marinated in this language enough to understand that what they're saying is you should take care of. So if we use that language, then so I should be taking care of everyone out there who needs me. You have a computer now that works just fine. You have. So I'm going to give everything I have. And it's easier for me in our time to make it relevant to talk about time, attention, emotional energy, psychological energy. I'm going to give it all out there means then there's nothing left over here. Margot?
I think there is one person in every extended family that, like, exemplifies this. Like, just one or a few. Like, there's a cousin or an aunt who's, like, just serving everybody else and giving it all away and just very modest, but that person is just serving the family, let's say. And it is, I feel that it's hard to be like, how do we repay you for the service and how do we give to you for what you give out to us? I think three nuances and different per family.
That what?
Nuances and different per family, how we show how we give back to this person. But I think it's an archetype. I mean, I don't think that everyone is equipped to serve and give to the extent that it becomes your martyrdom or your mission, or that is your, you know, your saintly mission is to serve. You know, to give all, essentially.
But let's be clear that what this source is coming to do is say, taking the extreme that need is what determines priority.
Right.
It's not coming to talk about how we give back to the person. Right. We're not talking about that.
Right.
That's not what we're talking about. We're not talking about forgiveness. We're not talking about giving back to the person. We're not talking about that. What we're talking about is if need is the only determinant of where I put my resources, then the person that you're talking about is completely justified.
Yeah.
You don't have to give back to them. They don't care about that. The rabbis are concerned about where are they putting their time and energy? Yeah. What if the person you're talking about in the family is married with kids or is running a daycare and is supposed to be paying attention to the folks here?
Yeah.
And is, I guess what I'm saying is, like, the extreme of need is the most primary basis of how we determine where we put most of our resources. Then guess who suffers? The folks. Somebody give me back to this person. Who cares about that?
Well, I do, because I'm like that. That's
okay. But But the rabbis are saying to you, Margot, look at that person and maybe have a conversation with that person about, huh, I notice you're spending a lot of your time, you know, or whatever. But the question is that that's not good either. Is what they're saying. It's ridiculous that the king has, or the person, whatever, that brought back the coin, has grain spilling out of the house and says to the daughter, none of it will go to buy your wedding dress. None of it will go to buy you a new laptop. Like, none of it. Because there are people who need more than you do. So at either extreme, it's not helpful. So, like, the rabbis are just taking us, or their Hartman is bringing forward the text that take us to the ridiculousness of being at the extremes of either, leaving us to live in the murky middle, Harvey.
You know, it's extreme and it's not extreme, because we do see this in this country with the evangelical church, where people do give, and of course the church says we need, and of course they have universities and buildings and mausoleums, and you know, what really is need, and how, who should you give it to, and what really is need? Because it is being abused in this way that this guy was being abused.
So we have conversations all the time about need. And so I think one of the biggest topics that Hartman is trying to help us hold, which the rabbis have always done for generations, it's not Hartman, it's like the rabbis are just bringing us the text forward. Is it, the Jewish tradition has always wrestled with what is need. And then, given that there is unlimited need and limited resources, by what means do we make the decisions about how and where we give? I just had a long email from a congregant that was about a value that they have and that they hold that they did not see expressed here at an event recently. And it's under Tikkun Olam, repairing the world. So let's just talk about Tikkun Olam. Like, forget money. Tikkun Olam. Our value is Tikkun Olam, repairing the world. Well, Rabbi, I saw, and here's a list of the ways that we failed to reach this person's understanding of what we could have done. To KI's stated values of Tikkun Olam. The question, of course, is not, are you right or wrong to this person? Like, you're right to push for your value in where we should spend our time, energy, resources, money, excluding other things, blah, 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 the criteria by which we do that. Our job all the time is to figure out, but is that the primary value of KI, this person's understanding of Tikkun Olam, you know, which is this big, and like in this situation, this one needs food, this one needs a laptop, this one needs, you know, new clothes to go to school, or this girl needs shoes to be able to even go to school. Like, so there's all these ways of understanding what Tikkun Olam means, what justice means, what tzedakah means. Then, so what I'm trying to say is it's an actual literal set of things we have to decide all the time as individuals, as a synagogue community, as a LA community, as America. Like, we are wrestling with this all the time.
But this starts off as a very easy algorithm. You'll hear first, and then it progresses toward fudge factor, page one, fudge factor, page two,
yes,
until you get to do the best you can what you think is right.
Well, yes, but I have to answer the congregant. And then we have to have a conversation as a staff about, okay, so what do we do next time? Like, do we shift because we think, okay, she's right, that we need to lean harder into that? Or do we think it's right to actually say more people don't want that than want that, and we have to serve our people? So I'm saying the rabbis understand fudge factors are real. We live in fudge.
Yeah,
it's a t-shirt, Stephen Lewis. We live in fudge. Yeah. So we live in fudge. And so, like, what they're trying to bring to us are some ways of trying to figure out, like, where we are in the whole tippy balance of this whole notion of from where do we make our moral decisions about how we spend our resources. Okay. Source six? No, you know what? No. 7, because we got it close.
Rabbis established the principle of do not wrong your fellow, Leviticus 25:17, and applied it to one who is with you in Torah and commandments. All who are from the nations that are guided by the ways of religion and serve God in any way, even though their faith is far from ours, are exactly like the Jews regarding these matters, whether in lost articles or in business errors, and in all other matters without distinction.
So, Harvey, this is about Fudge. So, because it was clear until a certain point in our history that Jews could only influence Jews. They could only impact Jews. They could only give tzedakah to Jews. They could only, the ways that we gave money and who we supported and whatever was only about Jews, because by definition, Jews had no authority anywhere except over their own communities. So it was easy to have that conversation. Well, not easy. It was not easy, but they had a conversation. But it was like, all of these things apply to do not wrong your fellow from Leviticus, from the Holiness Code, means your fellow Israelite, your fellow Jew, right? Now here comes the Meiri, right, who is a French philosopher saying, and he was a medieval French philosopher saying, and he had very warm relationships with his Christian neighbors. And he comes to say, well, yeah, your fellow Jew was in one context, but that's not what it means anymore. Because if you look at the Torah says your fellow in Torah and mitzvot, right? Living a righteous life. Well, the Christians pull from our Bible and are doing the same thing. So now the category needs to expand beyond Jew living by Torah and mitzvot to those who also understand themselves as being part of the covenant. Of course, they're part of a new covenant also, but read themselves into the original covenant. So now they understand themselves as being living under the same system to some extent of Torah and mitzvah. So now we have to expand the category to include Christians that we're going to help who need our help. So the Meiri is saying, whatever our categories are, they have to be responsive to the time. So who is family? Like you heard me say earlier, family for me is not family of origin. When you ask me and my people about my family, they'll tell you my family. Fern, Cheryl, Sarah, Paula, Peg, Judy, like, right? Eliana, ask her to name her family. None of it is family of origin. So family becomes a term when we say give to our family first. The Meiri is saying, well, for Rabbi Amy, and for many of us, family now means the people most immediately in our circle, the most immediately in our care. It isn't family of origin. And by the same definition, the person who is involved in Torah and mitzvot doesn't mean anymore Jew. It means someone who understands themselves as obligated to be ethical and moral people under a system that we understand and kind of agree is a overarching system. So the Meiri is saying, even within the categories that Green and Singer would argue about, it's changing all the time about how we understand those categories. So it's not only Fudge that what ratio, how much, how little, to what extent. It's also Fudge about what do those categories actually mean. And we're living in a time now as Jews where that is more clear than ever that we are living in some ways, thank God, a time of Fudge. That it's not so much we say instinctively, our community is the Jewish community, right? That we have lots of communities to which we belong that we feel like we are equally a part. And we don't have to say it's my Jewish community first. And we have communities that we say, this is my family. And we mean that. So then like, what does that mean? Still in terms of our ethical obligations, in terms of where we give, how much we give, and how we make those decisions. So these three sets of class of creation ethics, covenant ethics, and then the tension between them is a way to Jewishly reflect on how do we begin to understand how we even have a conversation about how much we give, where is our priority. We are having this conversation. I'm looking at the president of the synagogue, Bert, on the board for a million years. Lisa, head of the community, former president, all of you who are joining community and being here and participating. These are real issues. These are real concerns. What we don't often talk about are the ways that we are actually going to make those decisions, right? We talk about from a knee-jerk place, I think this deserves more attention than that or more resources than that. I believe this one. That's fine. But what Hartman is asking us to think more deeply about is how do we understand our obligations, our shoulds, and what is that for each of us? And what is that for us as KI, as an institution? What is that for us as a Jewish people? What is that for us as a country? Because we're living in a time where there's more and more and more, to your point, a skewed, both in this country and in the world at large, a skewed allocation of resources and the gathering of more and more resources. I just watched a show that was talking about, you know, the world is controlled by the billionaire class. And if you think differently, you're an idiot or so naive that it's ridiculous. Don't think your vote actually is, and it wasn't about voting. It was a fictional show, but I was like, oh, wow, that landed hard. But it's true. The billionaire class really controls so much of what. So like, you know, where are we on that scale? Where are we in the terms of what we want to think about in terms of other countries, other populations that we have nothing in common with, but we know have been so gutted by our ability to have what we have that we owe them something. And like, so what is the scale by which we even start to talk about the undergirding, the underlying values by which we make these decisions as a board, as a community, as a country, as a world community? This is what the rabbis have always been thinking about. And what we tend to lack is a way Jewishly to speak about some of the ways of framing that, some of the ways of understanding that. And so that is Foundations for a Thoughtful Judaism tries to bring that forward for us to at least Jewishly begin to articulate some of the ways that our amazing fudging tradition has tried to hold some of these questions. And our obligation is to figure out how to like take that out and make them real decisions that can create a better and more just and compassionate and equitable society. Thanks.